You're tuned to Radio EcoShock for the world. In this week's show, a roundup of unsettling climate records in 2007.
But then, of course, I come at the issue of climate change from a perspective of deep time and previous greenhouse worlds.
Dr. Bob Spicer on previous greenhouse worlds and the new scientific activism. But first, is it time to party big time on the fossil fuel blowout? Then hook up the trailer and head up to the sunny Yukon, the tropical Norway, or crowded Tasmania. This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. On last week's show, we heard the uber gloomster James Lovelock deliver a crushing speech to Britain's Royal Society. Lovelock warned that a massive climate system change, with a long history of big changes on Earth, has been unleashed. Nature has taken over the show, so it doesn't matter what carbon puny humans might make now. And anyway, there's no time to change, he says. Even setting up massive solar panels in the desert or the multi-billion dollar wind farm off the coast near London can't happen soon enough, he says. Lovelock has a vision we all need to hear, I know. If you missed it, download his one-hour speech to the Royal Society from our website at ecoshock.org. But he's the kind of man who gets big things very right and big things quite wrong. Despite inventing a machine that could measure pollution in the atmosphere, including the CFCs that damaged the ozone layer, in the 1970s, James Lovelock testified for the chemical companies, saying CFCs were harmless. He was utterly wrong about that. In his biography, Lovelock admits he was also wrong on another issue. He backed big agriculture, their drive to tear down English hedgerows, and only later admitted this was a disaster for the ecology of Britain. And Lovelock has been a nuclear nut since day one. Reactors for everyone, and don't worry about the bomb. I wouldn't give up on recycling and alternative energy just yet. There is an interesting divide between the most radical British scientists, like James Lovelock and Chris Rapley, and American scientists like NASA's James Hansen and Dr. Michael Oppenheimer of Princeton. The critical point? How hot can it get? Is there a natural limit to the current warming? In a public lecture in Australia last summer, James Lovelock suggested that temperature may stop around 5 degrees hotter as the Earth reaches a new stable state. Remember, that's a world with a global average temperature hotter by 5 degrees Celsius over 9 degrees Fahrenheit. That's one steaming planet. Last time it was that hot, many millions of years ago, reptiles swam in the Arctic Sea, and our tropical rainforests arose at latitudes now covered with Siberian ice. Our so-called temperate zones were scrubby deserts then, inhospitable for most life. And that's America, Europe, and China we're talking about, friends, so Lovelock isn't offering any feel-good news. But he thinks that burning the rest of fossil fuels won't necessarily make it any worse. We'll hear more about the Earth's other face, that hot state planet, from our next guest this week, Dr. Bob Spicer of Open University in the UK, a specialist in deep time. But meanwhile, James Lovelock doesn't offer any scientific evidence for his upper limit of 5 degrees of warming. Is it a gut feeling from a man who originated and believes deeply in the Gaia hypothesis? The Gaia theory holds that living things created the atmosphere, especially the oxygen, required for life as we know it. In an almost religious manner, Lovelock seems to believe that life has methods of preserving itself, even in wildly changing climatic conditions. Of course, all of that adaptation happened over millions, even billions of years. There has never been a case where an organism like ourselves has hauled out a few hundred million years of concentrated solar energy in oil and coal and dumped it into the atmosphere in 100 or 200 years. This isn't Earth history in action. This is a brand new game initiated by humans. A group of leading American scientists dispute the idea that there is any limit to global heating. Here is a quick clip from Dr. Michael Oppenheimer of Princeton University speaking at a breakfast meeting for financial movers and shakers in 2007.
What's going on now, definitely, is that the greenhouse gases are building up due to human activity, not due to these biological changes. And there's nothing to reverse that except us reversing emissions, nor do we know of any limit in the climate system that would stop the warming. There could be one. Maybe when we get to 4 to 5 degrees warming, there's something that happens that we don't know about. There's a lot we don't know. But, you know, we can't make policy based on a hope.
Another American scientist, Dr. James Hansen, head scientist of the Goddard Space Division of NASA, is even more explicit. Not only is there not a known mechanism to stop climatic heating, there may be nothing stopping humans damaging the Earth so badly that its atmosphere begins to look more like the dead planet Venus. For example, Hansen says in this rooftop interview with independent journalist Maria Gallardin,
"We did not realize until recently that previous warm periods, the previous so-called interglacial periods, some of which were warmer than the present one, were not very much warmer. At most, 1 degree warmer than the present period. On the other hand, there were times, if we go back 3 million years ago, when the Earth was about 3 degrees warmer, but it was a different planet. There was no sea ice in the Arctic, and sea level was at least 15 meters higher, probably about 25 meters higher. That's 80 feet. I mean, that's a huge climate change. It's something that we really would have a very hard time dealing with because we've set up all of our infrastructure with the coastlines where they are now."
But unlike James Lovelock, James Hansen is far from ready to start building refugee camps in the far north. Over the past few years, he has proposed various ways that America and Western civilization generally could control and greatly reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. That would include cutting powerful greenhouse gases like methane, in addition to the carbon dioxide we hear so much about. In a speech in Texas in the fall of 2007, Hansen suggested there is still time even to save the Arctic if we moved very fast in a new energy economy. As Hansen has been on the forefront of climate science, despite threats and attempted censorship by the Bush administration, I can't discount his optimism as the typical American Pollyanna denial. Hansen has been specific about realistic plans and goals. He just thinks an oil lobbyist administration has blocked legitimate action. So don't give up on climate action to cut greenhouse gases just because James Lovelock tells you it's all too late. We can save some of the ecosphere, our way of life, and many species simply by changing our ideas and our lifestyles. At the very least, we can limit the damage and prevent a complete runaway scenario of storms, fires, droughts, and heat. Let's give Earth a chance. I'm Alex Smith, and that's my resolution for the new year. We'll hear from our special guest, an expert in past climates, Dr. Robert Spicer, in just a minute. But first, I'd like to whet your appetite for change with just a quick review of key climate change news that slipped through the cracks of the holidays news machine. According to Seth Borenstein of AP News, experts say the 2007 was a year of weather extremes. For example, 263 record heat temperatures were broken in the U.S. alone. If you remember last January, when New Yorkers were playing tennis instead of shoveling snow, that January was the warmest first month of the year ever recorded by humans on planet Earth. It was 1.5 degrees hotter than normal, the biggest rise for any month, anywhere, since record-keeping began. Scientists are still calculating, but 2007 was definitely one of the hottest years on record, if not the hottest. Borenstein writes, England had the warmest April in 348 years of record-keeping there, shattering the record set in 1865 by more than 1.1 degrees Fahrenheit, end quote. It wasn't just the heat. There was a tornado in New York City last August, and that's definitely not normal. Strange storms struck up all over the world. Nobody can remember anything like the cyclone that hit Oman and Iran in the Middle East last June. Violent thunderstorms are becoming common in Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia. Old-timers there can't remember any such thing. Another big oil pumper, Abu Dhabi, is planning one of the world's really sustainable cities. It will be a zero-emission city in the desert. It's called Masdar, which means the source in Arabic. The city will include natural air conditioning provided by a combination of wind towers and traditional Arabic design. The leaders of Abu Dhabi have been investing in alternative energy. Why not? They know very well, even if we don't, that oil will run out someday and sooner rather than later. Meanwhile, still the world's biggest polluter and consumer of oil products, the United States still seems blissfully unaware that their climate has changed. People in the Southeast continue driving gas hogs while everyone from small towns to the mighty city of Atlanta are praying for rain. Their drinking water reservoirs came close to drying up this year, and agriculture was blasted by drought and heat. In Florida, Lake Okeechobee was the lowest ever last May. Further north, the giant Lake Superior shrunk to its lowest summer levels since records began. Los Angeles also had its driest year ever. In Australia, the longtime government of John Howard fell, in part because he continued to deny the role of climate change in that country's devastating drought. In other parts of the world, the new phenomenon of heavy rains appeared. Whole English towns that have stayed above water since medieval times flooded, as unbelievable fast rains clogged old drainage systems. It's drought or drowning in the new regime, apparently. A world record for the most rain in 72 hours was set this year on Reunion Island, 400 miles east of Africa. That was 155 inches of rain in 3 days. More than 12 feet of rain, people, or almost 4 meters of rain in 3 days. China also experienced the heavy rain phenomenon this year. As predicted by climate scientists, much of the warming happened at night when people notice at least. Both plants and animals have a higher heat mortality when they can't cool off at night. There were 15 heat-related deaths in Georgia last August, the month that 100 all-time American records for heat were tied or broken. Dozens of people died in Europe due to extreme heat last summer.
And the envelope, please.
Of course, the biggest weather story of the year was in the Arctic. The summer sea ice melted back to record levels, opening up the fabled Northwest Passage. Scientists are aghast at what this means. Many are recalculating their models of the speed of climate change and adding the word abrupt to our current state. You can get more on what scientists are saying about the ice melt in the Arctic from our Radio EcoShock special for December 14, 2007. Just look in our program archives at ecoshock.org for the free download. Even the insurance industry is deeply worried about how much climate change is costing them. As Reuters reported on December 27, 2007, it was a year not of the mega disaster like Katrina, but a whole string of costly, smaller-scale natural disasters, so-called, that caused at least $75 billion in damage. Not all of that was insured. The companies had to pay out about $30 billion, double the damages paid out in 2006. Not a great time to be in the insurance industry. One of the largest reinsurers, Munich Re, counted 950 weather disasters, the most since they began keeping records in 1974. Reuters quoted Torsten Gjerwerk of the Munich Re board saying, "The trend in respect of weather extremes shows that climate change is already taking effect, and that more such extremes are to be expected in the future." So they don't doubt this crazy weather is due to human-induced climate change. One of the most costly events for the insurance companies was a storm that North Americans hardly heard about. That was the winter storm Kirill last January, when American channels were raving about warm weather in New England and eastern Canada. Kirill killed 49 people and caused $10 billion in damage. But the deadliest world weather disaster hit part of the world where people don't buy insurance. Cyclone Sidr killed 3,300 people in Bangladesh and India just this past November, and cost at least $2.3 billion in counting. It was the Katrina of the East, but that doesn't matter in the Western media or mindsets. None of this climate chaos even makes the U.S. presidential candidate debates. As Alan Goodman wrote in the Boston Globe December 28th, of the 2,275 questions on the Sunday morning talk shows, the League of Conservation Voters counted only 3 on global warming, end quote. Everyone talks about family values, Iraq, the economy, but climate change demolishing the American landscape and the way of life, along with peak oil, well, who cares? People are more worried about lead and Chinese toys, so the media tells us, but I think you know better. Meanwhile, I've looked everywhere for a simple mainstream media video of Al Gore's speech as he received his Nobel Peace Prize for his climate work. It's not there. We can find the text, but few American TV watchers heard Al Gore say this: "Without realizing it, we have begun to wage war on the Earth itself. Now we and the Earth's climate are locked in a relationship familiar to war planners, mutually assured destruction." End quote. All right, that's all I've got to say about that, as Forrest Gump would say. Later in the program, I'm going to make a prediction for 2008 about the new movement of scientist activists. But first, let's get to our feature interview. What can past climate change tell us about the present? Let's talk with a deep time specialist. Dr. Robert Spicer is a professor at the Open University in the United Kingdom, and he works with CEPSAR, the Center for Earth, Planetary Space, and Astronomical Research. He's also been a key consultant to several high-profile BBC specials on climate change. Professor Spicer, at the recent presentation by Sir James Lovelock to the Royal Society, you described yourself as someone working with deep time and previous greenhouse worlds. Can you tell us just a little bit about those previous hot states? What was it like?
Well, for about 80% of the last 500 million years, the global mean surface temperature of the Earth has been warmer than it is now. So that means we are living in a somewhat cool period in Earth history. Now, what that means is that there is a huge amount of information in the rock record, fossils, sediments, isotopes, that tells us how the world works when it's warmer than it is now, a situation where we may well be returning to. So by looking at the sediments and rocks, fossils, this kind of thing, we can understand a lot more about how the world works and understand those processes that at the moment are rather difficult for us to see in the world around us. So let's take ourselves back to the time of the dinosaurs, for example. Let's go back around about 70 to 100 million years ago. Now, this is a world in which there are no ice caps to speak of. There may have been a small one at elevation in Antarctica, but the northern hemisphere and the Arctic in particular was essentially ice-free. Now, instead of having the ice flows and the rather cold situation that we have now, what we had were extremely lush forests, growing to as far north as 85 degrees north. And within these forests, we have dinosaurs running around. If you go south from there into the more temperate regions, through into the subtropics and the tropics appear to be a lot drier than they are now, with seasonal rainfall rather than year-round rainfall. So that means that in terms of the ability of the forest to sequester carbon from the atmosphere, most of the effective carbon locking up and vegetation growth was at the high latitudes, near the poles. And this is the kind of situation that we're likely to return to in the not-too-distant future.
Well, how do we know what happened so long ago? What kind of tools do time explorers use?
Well, we can look at isotopes of oxygen. These give us some idea of temperature, but mostly these are used for marine situations. So we can look at the surface temperature of the oceans, and we can also look at the bottom temperatures of the oceans, because different organisms live in different heights in the water column, and if they bring the oxygen isotopes that are in the water into their shells, for example, and these are preserved through time, then we can tell something about the temperature profiles. But as I said, these are mostly marine. We can do it on land, but it's not quite so straightforward because we have the effect of rain and various other things. We can also look at the distribution of sediments. So, for example, if we find coal, then we know that it must have been warm enough for plant growth to occur and wet enough not only to provide the plants with water but also to preserve the carbon in those plants. In other words, you need to build up large bodies of peat and this kind of thing. If we look at bauxites or laterites, these are minerals or sediments that form under warm and wet conditions. There are a variety of clay minerals that require certain combination of warmth and wetness to form. And at the other end of the extreme, we can look at things like evaporites, salt beds. Now, where these form is where there is an extremely high evaporation rate relative to precipitation, rainfall. And so these tend to occur in hot, dry environments, but they don't have to be hot, just as long as the evaporation is high. Now, from the plant perspective, this is something which I specialize in. Plants, as you appreciate, as you travel around the world, are very specific to certain conditions, mostly climate. So if you go, for example, to California or the Mediterranean or to Chile, the vegetation there looks very similar, even though the species which are growing are quite different. Similarly, if you go to the rainforests in Southeast Asia or the rainforests in Africa or the rainforests in South America, a rainforest looks very similar, but again, the species may not be the same. So climate constrains the architecture of plants in very stable ways, largely because the architecture is a function of the laws of physics, fluid transport, evaporation, gas diffusion, these sorts of things. And these laws don't change with time. So a plant's architecture ends up by being an engineering solution to a particular set of environmental constraints. And what we can do is, when we find fossil plants, we can decode the architecture in terms of climate. So one technique that I've been developing, along with a number of colleagues, is to look at the architecture of leaves. Leaves are exposed to the atmosphere. They process the atmosphere through photosynthesis and the like. And so the shape and size and characteristics of a leaf tend to be very closely related to the climate to which that leaf is exposed. And we can code leaves mathematically, numerically, and put them into a program that we have. And so when we find fossil leaves, we can read out things like temperature, mean annual temperature, to within 1 or 2 degrees of uncertainty. Warm month mean, cold month mean, precipitation during the growing season, the length of the growing season, humidity, and a very special characteristic called enthalpy, which we can use for determining paleoaltitude, ancient altitudes. And using this technique, we've been able to determine what the temperatures were like in the Arctic when these forests were growing. And so we can build up a picture not only of the vegetation, the plant dynamics, but also very precisely, quantitatively, the climate under which those forests were growing.
Well, you know, even the most educated among us were not taught much about Earth's history. I mean, so much is just being discovered now. Do you see the schools trying to play catch-up to teach us more about the planet's past climate?
Well, I hope so, because it's absolutely essential that everyone understands the complexity of the Earth system. There are no simple solutions to managing climate change. And people have to, as it were, appreciate the glorious complexity of the world in which we live. Now, in the past, in schools, people have tended to teach biology, chemistry, physics as quite separate subjects. But in Earth system science, it brings all of those subjects together, and you can see the relationship one to the other. Now, of course, in the school children today are going to be those that have to manage climate change much more than we do. I say we do because, you know, I'm quite a mature individual, shall we call it that. And I'm not going to be around to actually see the worst of climate change as it appears to be unfolding at the moment, particularly if we don't get a grip on carbon emissions into the atmosphere. And the reason why I'm particularly concerned is that when we look at deep time, when we look at these ancient environments and ancient climates, what it seems to suggest to me is that the future world, of a world of global warming, largely due to human activities, is actually going to be a world in which we see much greater change than is suggested by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And I'm quite happy to explain why I think that if you wish me to.
Well, yes, I would like to know about that. I think everyone's trying to gauge the IPCC's predictions, and we have had other scientists saying, well, that's not enough, and it's happening faster than that. So, yes, please give us a few tips on that.
Okay. Well, the IPCC is a terrific organization, and I don't wish to be overly critical of it. It's managed to bring together consensus amongst thousands of climate scientists, despite everyone having their own particular area of expertise. So it's a fantastic achievement. However, because the IPCC report has to be effectively agreed to by a large number of world governments, the IPCC has to provide information which is, one, quantified, and, two, has quantified uncertainties. That is to say, we have to be able to predict what the changes in the future are likely to be and what our level of confidence in those changes are. Now, some processes which are happening at the moment, we don't know enough about in order to quantify the uncertainties. And one example of this is the rate of mass loss of ice from Greenland, for example. In the last 5 years, that's accelerated enormously. The IPCC doesn't really understand, or the scientists in IPCC don't really understand those processes, and therefore the IPCC fourth assessment, which came out in January, explicitly says that it has ignored that. So any estimate of sea level rise is likely to be a very conservative one. But my particular area is a different concern. Now, when we reconstruct paleoclimate using a variety of techniques, and the leaf technique I just explained is but one of a whole array of techniques, we tend to find that the conditions that we envisage happening in the past, whether it be in the greenhouse world of 100 million years ago or 50 million years ago or even 150 million years ago, when we reconstruct those and we ask the climate modelers to apply the climate models which are used in the IPCC to make forward forecasts to try and retrodict or look back at these ancient times, we find that despite 30 years of model development, the modelers are unable to do that. So the biggest disparities, the biggest difference between the model results and the observations in the geological record tend to be in precisely those areas where we're seeing the greatest change at the moment, and that is in continental interiors and at high latitudes. And we've recently done some work in Russia, in Siberia, where we have looked at fossil leaves that are around about 80 million years old, and we have determined what the climate was like based on fossil leaves, on the overall fossil assemblage. Basically, we're looking at a vegetation that's rather similar to that which you would find in Florida today, a warm, temperate forest, very diverse. There's over 170 spore and pollen taxa there, which is an incredibly biodiverse area. And clay minerals, for example, they all suggest a warm, wet environment. And when we look at the leaves and numerically decode them, we're looking at a mean annual temperature of around about 13 degrees Celsius, with a cold month mean just above freezing, around about 5 degrees Celsius. Now, when we ask the models to try and reproduce that, what we find is that the models are telling us that the cold month mean ought to have been minus 20. So that is of concern, because no matter where we do these kinds of comparisons, the models are always very conservative. The models are all, and it doesn't matter which model you use, the models used for climate predictions are all based in weather forecasting. So the models are tuned to give you a very good representation of the here and now. Yet when we look at the models from the point of view of trying to predict the future, we're obviously asking the models to do something which is very different to the here and now. Similarly, when we ask the models to look back in time to a different set of circumstances, the models only know the present. And so they tend to give estimates of climate which are very strongly biased towards the present. It doesn't matter what we do to the models. We can change the paleogeography, the positions of the continents. We can change the composition of the atmosphere. We can do a large number of experiments with these models. But no matter what you do to them, you still cannot get the models to reproduce those conditions which we see in the rock record. Now, if we go the other way into the future, what this means is the models are underestimating the degree of possible future change because the models are anchored in the present. Do you see where I'm
I do see that, and that's a serious problem. We're talking with Professor Robert A. Spicer, who works with CEPSAR and the Warm Earth Environmental Systems Research Group based in the UK. Professor Spicer, listening to expert scientists, I've heard several discussions about rapid climate change in as little as a decade, perhaps, but most of these were abrupt cooling. Were there rapid warming events, as we may be experiencing now?
Yes, there have been a number of very rapid warming events. And I'll tell you about one which we've been working on here at the Open University, and that is going back to the early part of the Jurassic. Most people are familiar with the Jurassic Park scenario. And for many years, we thought the Jurassic was quite a stable climate. But there is evidence now to suggest that there were very rapid warmings. So if we go back to around about 180 million years ago, I think I've got that number right, I may be wrong, but about that time, and look at the mud rocks that we have in Yorkshire, in northern England, and take very, very detailed, closely spaced samples of carbon isotopes through many meters of sediment. What we find is that there are some very rapid changes in the carbon isotopes, which are indicative of large amounts of methane being released into the atmosphere. Now, these appear to be periodic. They are paced on timescales of about several hundred thousand years. In fact, we believe that the methane release is due to slight warmings that occur due to changes in the orbit of the Earth. This is all very understandable. We know that the Earth's orbit changes with time. This is what paced the waxing and waning of the ice sheets during the what we call the last ice age. Same things were going on back in the Jurassic, but instead of leading to waxing and waning of ice sheets, what was happening was that methane periodically was being released from the deep ocean. And I should perhaps explain here that methane can be stored at temperature, at low temperatures and depth in the ocean as a thing called a clathrate, which is kind of an ice that holds methane. And it is stable on the continental slopes at certain pressures and temperatures. But if you increase the temperature, for example, then that methane can be released into the atmosphere. When it's released into the atmosphere, it not only has an immediate, very strong greenhouse effect, but over time it oxidizes to carbon dioxide, and that remains in the atmosphere for hundreds of thousands of years, again causing a warming. Now, back in the Jurassic, we think that the methane releases back then gave rise to a global mean surface temperature rise of between 5 and 8 degrees Celsius, and it took over 100,000 years each time for the Earth system to reabsorb what was then carbon dioxide back into the Earth and cool the planet down again. So it gives us not only an indication of extremely rapid warming events, but also it tells us how long it takes the natural system to readjust and bring temperatures back down to what they were before the event occurred. And if you're talking about timescales of 100,000 years to do that with a world clothed in forests, unlike agricultural surfaces today, which are not as effective at sequestering carbon dioxide, it gives us something to think about in terms of how long it will take for the world to adjust to the assault of carbon dioxide that we're putting into the atmosphere at the moment. And if you look back at these methane releases in the past, the kind of assaults on the atmosphere that they caused are somewhat similar to the ones which we are doing, which human beings are responsible for at the moment. So climate change is something we're going to have to live with for a very, very long time.
You know, this leads me back to our discussion about the IPCC. I wanted to ask, given the unexpected mass of ice that disappeared from the Arctic Sea last summer, is it possible that major climatic events will develop more rapidly than our patient scientific methods can really digest or understand them? Is the scientific method going to be enough?
That's a very interesting question, and this was brought into sharp focus recently. A colleague in New Zealand told me of a dialogue that went on during the Australian elections, where the politicians were being challenged on what their response was to the droughts followed by flooding events in Australia, and asked whether or not this was a function of global warming. And the politician's response was, "We don't know, but if it was, we can't be held responsible because the scientists didn't tell us clearly enough that this was likely to be one of the consequences." Now, of course, I would dispute that. The information on what you do if you double atmospheric carbon dioxide has been out in the scientific literature and the public domain since the late 1800s. Arrhenius did the calculations, which suggested that there would be a 4 degrees Celsius increase in global mean surface temperature if you doubled atmospheric CO2, and that sort of level of increase is precisely that which even our most sophisticated climate models are suggesting today. But the interesting thing there is that if the IPCC is regarded as being very conservative, which for reasons I explained earlier I think it is, and if climate change turns out to be a lot more dramatic than the IPCC is suggesting it is, there is a danger that in future either politicians or the public at large will turn around and say the scientists did not do their job. They did not tell us what the likelihood of these dramatic changes were. And that, I think, is a potential problem. Now, the scientific method, yes, it does require an awful lot of careful observations, whether it be in the rocks of the past or the atmosphere of today, oceans of today. Yes, it does take a while. But there are sufficient voices out there saying, just a minute, we already know that the Earth can react really quite quickly and really quite strongly to the kind of, as I said earlier, assaults on the Earth system that human beings are responsible for. And I would say that, yes, the IPCC is the most benign view of the future, but if we are going to effectively plan adaptation and mitigation strategies, then I think we have to assume that it's likely to be a lot worse than that.
For self-informing amateurs like myself, what resources would you recommend to find out more about this developing knowledge of Earth's climate history?
Well, there are a variety of books out there. One of the best ones that I've seen is The Rough Guide to Climate Change. In fact, I've got it on my desk in front of me. That has been recently updated, and it gives you most of what you need to know, including a little bit of deep time. But we are publishing papers, scientific papers, all the time, and they are getting into the public domain. The Siberian work I've just explained or told you about will be published very shortly, and I'm hoping that there will be some attention paid to that, because, as I said, as despite 30 years of model development, we still don't really understand why the models can't reproduce these climates of the past. It's a constantly developing field. I would refer people to things like the journals like The New Scientist, which is written in such a way that people can readily access it, even or access the science, even though they don't necessarily have the in-depth knowledge. I think that's probably most of what I can recommend at this point in time.
Well, we've barely scratched the surface, I know. Is there something else you would really like our listeners to know?
I think be patient. We're in it for the long haul. One of my worries is that public interest and media interest and political interest has a reputation for being somewhat short-lived, and yet we are going to have to deal with the processes and consequences of climate change for many, many, many decades, and people will inevitably see gradual change in their lifestyle. Let me put this in context for you. The New Economics Foundation in the UK recently published a report where it tried to assess, and the methodology, I should point out, is constantly under revision, but tried to assess the carrying capacity of different standards of living. So, for example, if everybody in the world had a standard of living such as we have in the United Kingdom, we would require 3.1 planets, and those planets would have to be biologically productive over all land surfaces, which, of course, they are not. That, I think, gives you some indication of the level of lifestyle adjustment that will inevitably be taking place over the coming decades. As far as Canada is concerned, Canada is likely to be one country which effectively benefits from global warming, in as much as a lot more of Canada's land surface will become biologically productive, whether it be agriculture or forestry or whatever. You'll certainly be able to grow trees much, much higher latitudes, but they may not be quite the same trees as we have at the moment. If you go back to the Cretaceous, most of those polar forests were deciduous. So even the conifers were losing their leaves during the dark winters. We are going to see some fairly dramatic changes. The thing that worries me most is that things like sea level rise will impact on around about 90% of the world's population, simply because most people live at or near sea level. We are going to see massive changes in resource availability, whether it be water or food, for example. Resources have always been a flashpoint as far as conflict is concerned. And when you change the availability of resources, there's even more incentive for conflict, if you like. We will see flooding of the world's major cities on a fairly regular basis as sea level rises due to expansion of the seas due to warming, plus melting of the polar ice. And that is going to impact hugely on economic, social, and political activity. So we're in for a rocky ride. If people are aware of that, forewarned of that, I think most people are in a position to take a more intelligent view of the future. But it's not going to be easy. And as you said earlier, our children, I think, need to understand these kinds of processes and changes. And if they understand them, then I think there is a chance they'll be more resilient to them.
We've been talking with Dr. Robert Spicer, a professor at the Open University in Britain. Professor Spicer, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
I think it's great when a busy climate scientist will give up half an hour of valuable time just to get more of us up to speed on recent science. It's a sign that more scientists are beginning to come out of the labs and far-flung research stations to add another dimension to their work, public activism. This is one of the hot topics in scientific circles today. In the past, the prevailing model has been this. Scientists develop theories and proof over many years' time. They eventually offer their papers for peer review and publishing, a process that took more years. Then it was up to government specialists or maybe environmentalists to grab what they could and try to implement their new knowledge into public policy. To me, it kind of feels like this old-time radio skit that I pulled off the audio, direct, actuality uncut, from the control tower.
Central Command, this is Dr. Bill Stilton calling in from Orion Hills.
Go ahead, Doctor.
We've set up observation towers, and I have a report from our specialist, Linda Crawley. She's filmed a man with a pickup truck loaded with gasoline cans. He's pouring them out into the woods.
Okay, put out some heat sensors.
Will do. But Crawley has seen several small fires right behind the pickup truck.
Did she see the suspect light the fires?
No.
See if you can find a connection. We'll need proof.
We'll mount some more cameras and try for a close-up.
Bill, the fires are linking up. This could be serious.
Central Command wants more heat sensors and try and get some video of the suspect actually lighting the fires.
But we can't get in there now. It's way too dangerous. Some of our equipment has already burned. This could burn right down to the cities. We've got to get out and alert.
Central Command, Stilton here. Our scientist in the field says the fires are growing. Should we warn city authorities?
Bill, don't panic on this one. We need solid science before we get the mayors and the media involved. We don't know this is even man-made. It could be a natural forest fire. I'll send out more investigators.
What about the firefighters?
If it's natural, we can't stop it. You know that, Bill. Just do the job. Get the facts and leave the decisions to people who are hard to make decisions.
Bill, there are several more pickup trucks here. One has a large fuel tank on the back with a pump. Our sniffer sensors are picking up serious gasoline and diesel fumes.
The authorities have been alerted, Linda. But I can smell a little smoke here at my tower as well. I'll call command. Command, this is definitely a major fire, and we have reports of many different arsonists adding fuel to it. The equipment is showing high carbon levels in the air. This could be the big one.
Okay, we'll let the committee know. This may be a big fire. Don't talk to the press. Let us handle this. Keep watching it.
The fire is coming over the hill. It's huge, much bigger than we thought. We've got to run for it, Bill.
Crawley. Come in, Crawley. Crawley?
Well, that was a little radio fun, but unfortunately, faced with abrupt climate change and rapid breakdown of the very systems life scientists study, science can't keep up. Who is going to synthesize all the complex studies being done? Do we have trained general thinkers who can interpret this for the public? More importantly, can scientists keep working on a deteriorating world, at least for living things, without joining the struggle to save it? Will people just blame the scientists for not speaking up soon enough? Our guest Bob Spicer raised this very issue at that James Lovelock presentation.
That Australian politicians, when faced with questions about recent droughts there, started to shift the blame, as it were, and said, well, you know, if this is to do with global warming, it's the scientists' fault for not shouting loudly enough, early enough, so that we could take avoiding action.
Well, listen to what Paul Ehrlich, the author of The Population Bomb, way back in 1968, told a group of Australian environmental scientists at a conference, November 26, 2007.
So these are gigantic behavioral problems, problems of knowledge, problems of education. You're the people, you're a superb group of scientists who know what needs to be done, which brings me to my final topic for the last hour and a half of the talk, which is, what should Australian ecologists be doing about all this? You're one of the, you know, you do not want to underrate your power. If you get together, there are things called issue publics that sociologists look at. If you became an issue public, if hundreds of Australian scientists rose up and had said, last year, the world's going to be destroyed if we vote for Howard and his like anymore. This is not, we're not playing around. That the environment is not another constituency. It's not another political issue. It's our lives, our children's lives, our grandchildren's lives. You cannot afford a John Howard. Put him back. What was he before? A crooked used car salesman? I don't know. Most of our politicians were crooked lawyers, but it varies from country to country. Get rid of them. Get out there and picket them. Get the scientific community together against them. At least we tried in the United States. The Ecological Society of America now has the Aldo Leopold Leadership Program, which trains ecologists to talk to the general public, to talk to congressional committees and so on. You say, wow, that's not part of science. That's bullshit. You just persuaded that by the Howards of the world. Of course it's part of science. Do you get out there, for example, and does anybody complain when the medical community says smoking's likely to give you cancer? Only the cigarette manufacturers. Everybody else think it's perfectly reasonable for doctors to recommend that you don't smoke, that you get a flu shot, and on and on and on. They're not considered to be out of their realm. Sure, you don't say, I can prove scientifically that if we do X, Y, and Z, this will happen to the climate. But you can say, scientists say these are the likely consequences. And as a scientist and somebody who's looked at it closely, I recommend to you, Senator, this, that, or the other thing. And if you do this as an entire society, you can have impact. If you can get the media to cooperate. I don't know, how many of you know the 1993 statements of the Union of Concerned Scientists and the world's scientific academies? Well, few of you do. In 1993, the Union of Concerned Scientists got 1,500 of the most distinguished scientists in the world, including more than half of the Nobel laureates in science. And they got out a long statement which basically said, if we don't solve the population environment problem, we're screwed. And 58 academies of science, the Australian Academy, the Royal Society, the National Academy, and so on, got out a statement saying the same thing. The UCS actually hired a PR firm to push the statement. It never got anywhere in the press or the electronic media in the United States. Most people never heard of it. The world scientific community said, we are on a doomsday course. Literally, a collision course was the term in one of the statements. And nobody paid any attention. Getting the word out there is not easy. And one of your big jobs, in my view, is continue your ecological research. I could give you complaints about how ecological research is done today, but I won't bother, although I recommend Bill Lawrence's paper in the recent Australasian Ecology, I think it was called, about what Australian ecologists could be doing to broaden their impacts at our level. Spend 80% of your time doing the research you love. You wouldn't be in this business if you didn't love it. I would certainly not give up my time in the field looking for the painted honey eater just to save the world. I mean, the painted honey eater is one gorgeous bird. But take the other 20% or so and try and figure out how to improve your interaction with that other part of the complex adaptive system, namely the human system, that we understand now much less well than we understand the natural systems of the planet.
I hope to bring you Paul Ehrlich's bombshell speech on population, climate, and other eco-threats in a future show. James Lovelock addressed the same issues when he spoke to the Royal Society.
The climate scientist with whom we talk spoke of their observations and models of global heating in the regions that each of them were investigating. Taken separately, each of these regional investigations presented convincing evidence of positive feedback and accelerating change. They told of their research in detail, but in that detached and properly scientific manner we expect from all of us scientists. But it sounded to both of us almost as if they were describing some other planet, not the Earth. This was in itself disturbing, but much more so was the fact that those concerned, for example, with the melting of polar ice, although well aware of their colleagues working on a similar vanishing of the tropical forest, seemed to present their own research as something separate from the heating of the whole planet. There was also a tendency to present the whole Earth system as if it was no more than the simple addition of its parts, something I knew is rarely ever true of a dynamic system. Sandy and I left with a deep sense that what we'd heard was truly serious, and that the visit profoundly changed my views of the future. In defense of my friends at the Hadley Center, I have to say that almost everyone concerned with climate change in 2004, and that included me before the visit, had this same detached approach to climate research. We were worried, but there was no sense of pressing urgency. And I must add that this was all we perceived was the correct and objective way to think about it. When I looked at the IPCC report again, it was with a new sense of awareness. I now saw it as the scariest official document I'd ever read. It was all too clear that the message from the climate scientists was not reaching the public, and especially not in the United States.
He's saying that scientists can no longer be content to remain insulated from the big picture as they develop their specialties. What good will all this detailed record of our demise do us if rising seas and heat wipe out the best of our civilization, or lead to the deaths of billions of people? There are signs that a new movement of scientists is developing. Of course, the Union of Concerned Scientists has been an active social force for years, since the horror days of mutually assured destruction with atomic bombs. The U.S. branch of the Concerned Scientists have opened a new area of their website devoted to climate change. Find them at ucsusa.org/global_warming. That's ucsusa.org/global_warming. The Union of Concerned Scientists do good work, but they are underfunded. Yes, there is a blog called The Scientific Activist. It's handy, found at scienceblogs.com/scientificactivist. But it's hardly the worldwide movement we need. In Canada, the scientist and broadcaster David Suzuki has been demonstrating how scientific activism can work. But his foundation funding is limited by the constrictions of Canadian law. The most heartening recent global activism was the petition of at least 215 climate scientists, and these are the real one, folks, not the retired dentists from New Jersey that the anti-global warming folks seem to drag up. It came out on December 5, 2007. It was aimed at the politicians gathered at the Bali Climate Conference. One of the signatories, Jeff Severinghouse, a geosciences professor at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, told Associated Press, "It's a grave crisis, and we need to do something real fast. I think the stakes are way, way too high to be playing around." Andrew Weaver, a lead author of the IPCC, gave many newspapers their headline when he said, "The climate community is essentially fed up." The actual petition, which is unprecedented in the annals of science, says, quote, "If this trend is not halted soon, many millions of people will be at risk from extreme events such as heat waves, drought, floods, and storms. Our coasts and cities will be threatened by rising sea levels, and many ecosystems, plants, and animal species will be in serious danger of extinction," end quote. The scientists were pressuring world leaders to adopt real greenhouse gas controls quickly. They demanded our global greenhouse gas emissions be reduced by at least 50% below their 1990 levels by the year 2050. If we want to stay under 2 degrees of climate change, which is critical to life as we know it, global emissions will have to reach their peak and start declining before 2020, the scientists said. Of course, with the United States unwilling to commit to any binding reduction, the scientists' pleas for actions were not accepted. You can find my summary of the Bali Climate Conference failure at the EcoShock website. Look in our climate section. But the conception of what science is and what scientists can and must do has visibly shifted. We know that too many scientists have faced the choice of speaking out and losing their positions or critical funding, or staying quiet on public policy in order to keep really important research going. It's inhuman for them to be forced into such choices. We can all hope that the days of blunt government censorship of science is over. If we all want to survive in a workable world, we need to enable scientists as full citizens with a free voice. And scientists need to use their ability to communicate internationally to get action to preserve the Earth for future generations. That's one of my wishes for 2008, the new movement of scientific activism. Next week, we'll change topics as we play you one of the more sophisticated podcasts I've heard. Host George Kenney will interview Dr. Albert Bartlett on the coming double crisis of peak oil in an overpopulated world. Find Radio EcoShock on your local college or community radio station or on the web at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith, and I'd like to thank the listener-supported stations that broadcast this show. And thank you for joining us this week.